Hi, I'm Doug Henwood, and this is Almost Behind the News. Today's KPFA show was a fundraiser that featured only about two-thirds of the long interview with Jane McAlevey, author of a new book on her decade organizing workers into unions. A web audience wouldn't want to listen to all the fundraising, but I did want to share the full interview because it's really excellent. If you like these shows and want to keep them coming, please consider contributing to KPFA. You can do so on the web at kpfa.org. If it weren't for the credibility and reach that terrestrial radio still confers, I probably wouldn't be doing these shows. So please contribute. KPFA.org is a noble experiment in community broadcasting that's been around for more than six decades. Let's keep it going for another six. Please mention Behind the News with your pledge. Now on with the show. Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, an account of her decade organizing workers into unions using some really fresh strategies that actually work. Alas, her approach was just too bold for the dunderheads who run many American unions. I've taken some heat for having criticized American unions for being hidebound, paranoid institutions who make their critics' work all too easy. Often corrupt, many don't seem to care much about the interests of the larger working class who are not their members, and sometimes they don't care all that much about their members either. But I also believe that we can't have a better society without a better labor movement. No other institutions have the resources, human and financial, that they do. None have the potential leverage exercised through the strike and other disruptions of economic life that unions do either. But I write and talk as an outsider, a sympathetic outsider, but one without lots of inside experience. Jane McAlevey has lots of that sort of inside experience. And she's just written a very fine book, detailing the strategies she pursued and the obstacles she faced. Not just the predictable obstacles from corporate executives, but from within her own union. Jane took an unorthodox route into organized labor, something that makes some traditionalists nervous. She spent time in Central America during the wars of the 80s, then worked in the environmental justice movement, then in the Progressive Foundation, experiences that gave her a broad view of politics and the lives of the people that unions should be representing, but mostly aren't. Okay, here's Jane McAlevey. Welcome, Jane. You opened the book in Florida in the mania of the election fight in 2000. Why is that?
Really because it's a metaphor, I think, for a fundamental problem in the U.S. labor movement, which is its incredibly close, one some would say, inseparable relationship to the Democratic Party. I think by opening the book in Florida and looking at the Florida recount and the inability or the unwillingness of the American labor movement to sort of break strategy from Al Gore's team and from the Democrats in terms of what we needed to do to win, to me, that's a great reflection of sort of an ongoing problem in the American labor movement.
I recall at the time Paul Gigot of the Wall Street Journal described throwing a bourgeois riot in Florida. What had the labor movement, or could it have done?
Frankly, almost every single day there were a lot of us who were making suggestions to do things like street heat, to start doing large protests, to start having teams chasing Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State, with sort of old, telegenic, lovely African-Americans and Jews, you know, I think I talked about in the book with signs that would say, because these were proposals we were literally making every morning, saying, you know, stop stealing votes from our grandparents. I mean, there were a series of direct actions that many of us were proposing on a daily basis that we thought needed to happen to create a different narrative about how the recount was unfolding in Florida. And the AFL-CIO, quite a few of my higher-ups agreed that we should have been doing that, but there was a complete unwillingness to sort of challenge the legal team from the Gore campaign, or the top officials in the Democratic Party, even if people thought some of the ideas were right. And it was that, there was sort of this moment for me of, this is not the time to be fearful about breaking strategy with the Democratic Party. They can go run the recount, and we've got the top organizers in the country down here. We should be out running an organizing strategy, frankly, not organizing, it's too short a timeline, a mobilizing strategy to put people into the street to challenge the sort of Republican operatives in the recount. And we did nothing of the sort. And to me, that becomes a metaphor for what happens from, say, 2008 to 2012 under Obama, when people in the labor movement are told, you know, behave, or you're not going to be invited into the party in the White House. And people sort of behaved and politely asked for labor law reform, for example, and in the end got nothing.
I was amazed that they actually thought card check was going to sail through. I don't know what they were thinking. But Bill Fletcher told me on this program sometime back that a senior labor leader told him that it's better to be inside and not listened to than it is to be outside.
Yeah, well, that would be a fundamental problem with the American labor movement right now, right? If that is the reigning philosophy, you know, I can't say that that's what it is, but it sounds right to me. I certainly think that that proposal has not gotten American workers very far in 70 years, let alone the last 10 or 20.
So let's step back. How do you find yourself working for the labor movement? Some people inside the labor movement have criticized you for being some sort of outsider. So give us the good resume, how you ended up in this sometimes unrewarding line of work.
Well, let me say, I think it's actually really rewarding generally, working with workers and helping people learn how to fight their employer and learn how to understand their impression is totally satisfying. But there are other things which we may return to that can be unsatisfying. But, you know, first of all, I think the whole accusation of an outsider at a time when in the private sector, the labor movement represents 7% of the American workforce, it's like 93% are outsiders. So if the accusation is that because I did work as a janitor and a cleaner when I was young to survive, because I waited tables when I was young to survive, but I was working in a non-unionized facility, that makes me an outsider, that's also part of the problem. And that gets to part of the problem with, I think, some of the elements who consider themselves sort of the radical elements in the U.S. labor movement. The idea of the outsider is a rather inefficient notion, I think. So how I find my way in, first of all, I'm the daughter of a trade union family. So I guess if your parents were rank and filers who met success with the labor movement and you grew up in a union household, but you've graduated to something above sort of abject poverty because of the union, it means that you're an outsider when you come in as the next generation. You know, the whole thing to me is like, I'm being serious. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. I understand the sort of frequent use of the term, but I would assert that I was anything but an outsider. So I grew up in a union household, spent my childhood on picket lines, gone to work at a place called the Highlander Center, which our movement is so bifurcated between workplace and non-workplace and community and labor at this point that most people in the American labor movement didn't even understand that the place I come from by origin was the Training Education School for the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. That's what the Highlander Center was in its founding years. For 20 plus years, literally the top training arm for the CIO in America. So how that then positions me when I enter the labor movement to be an outsider is perfectly fascinating. In between, when I was working at Highlander, I spent many years working in the environmental justice movement. And that meant I was often working with workers in working class and poor communities, mostly through 14 states in the Deep South, who were fighting corporations more from the outside, although sometimes using OSHA, but more from the outside, trying to demand things like whole new water systems for their family when the single corporation in a small town in the South poisoned every single kid and led to things like leukemia and hair loss and poison and death. And you know, that's sort of how I spent my early years.
So how did you find yourself working for a labor movement? How did that happen?
Yeah, okay, great question. Right, so there's a segue, and the segue is that I'm recruited out of the field by a foundation, and that's the Beach Program. And the Beach Program is a foundation that, to this minute, is one of the better sort of funders of progressive organizing work in America. So there is this sort of funny segue where I get recruited to go work at a foundation, and I'm at the foundation, and in exactly year two, I said to the foundation executive, Margie Fine, I'm going to be leaving here at exactly year three because I'd committed to 3 years, thinking that maybe it wasn't the right place for me. In the end, I didn't think it was. I'm an organizer by sort of origin, and I like to be in the field. So in that time period of when I was sitting at the Beach Program, we were actually moving money to some very important progressive movements inside of the labor movement. We were funding the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, for example. We were funding the Association for Union Democracy. These would be core and very important institutions that take up the union democracy banner inside the American labor movement. So as I began to work with, we were also pioneers in sort of funding both the immigrant rights movement and sort of the worker center movement. That's what the foundation was doing. So we were in some ways on the cutting edge of trying to support the sort of progressive and left voices inside the American labor movement. And in that time frame, so one, we're already
not necessarily in the workplace.
Not necessarily in the workplace. And the role of foundations and their ability to support, well, TDU, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
The Association for Union Democracy and Teamsters for a Democratic Union
yeah.
were core in the funding program that we led. And I think that's an interesting point to come back to later in the discussion in terms of who some of those elements are. But so we were very involved in supporting ways to make a better labor movement. I think that's a simple way of saying it, right? By both opening up to immigrants, in the case of the immigrant rights movement, by opening it up to sort of immigrants through the worker center movement, by opening up unions in terms of creating more democratic unions with the Association for Union Democracy and the Teamsters for Democratic Union. So there's a set of organizations that we were directly involved in funding and that I was helping to support with someone else's taxpayer money. And then in 1995, the moment that Teamsters for Democratic Union, Association for Union Democracy, and many progressives have been campaigning for happens, which is a contested election, the first contested election in the history of the American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations. That's late 1995, when the election actually happens. That's going to put President Sweeney in over the old guard who had been running the AFL-CIO into the ground for decades leading up to that moment. And I had the pleasure, as I tell the story in the book, I had the pleasure of sort of actually being near outside, around the convention hall, getting briefings from people like Peter Olney and Ken Paff from TDU and a lot of very important players back at that time about what was sort of happening, what were the chances for success. And the second the victory happened, I knew it was finally time for me to return to my family's roots and get centrally involved in the union movement by working for unions and working with workers directly. The only reason, parenthetically, that I hadn't for the first sort of 10 years of my progressive work was really because I had spent a lot of time working in Latin America, traveling in Latin America, in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala in the 1980s, learning Spanish and trying to just understand U.S. foreign policy in the region. And in those years is when I was in El Salvador when Febe Velasquez was killed and a bunch of key trade unionists in the Salvadoran progressive movement were actually blown up by the forces from the U.S. government, let's say it that way, right, by forces supported by the U.S. government in their attack on trade unionists, in particular in El Salvador. And there were very strong links to the AFL-CIO's AFILD, to the foreign policy arm of the AFL-CIO, who had been infiltrating and undermining the progressive movements in Central America. And I was incredibly influenced by that as a very young person. Like, there's something so wrong with the labor movement in America that the AFL-CIO is implicated in supporting death squads in Latin America, killing actual trade unionists. So for me, it took until there was a new leader, his name was President Sweeney, and a new slate of people who had campaigned to say, we're going to fundamentally change our approach to foreign policy. They understood that there was something wrong with the foreign policy arm of the AFL-CIO. And at that moment is when I came inside.
There was a great moment when George H.W. Bush slipped and said AFL-CIA, I think, in a Labor Day speech.
And that is what many people used to call it, yes.
I'm speaking with Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, just out from Verso. Okay, let's talk about whole worker organizing. Now, we do hear a lot about community labor partnerships. You have trouble with that term. Why is that?
I do because I think it fundamentally third parties the worker in the community. In the union movement, in the best of organized labor, and let's be clear, there is no monolithic union in this country, right? We've got very different kinds of unions that exist in the United States of America. I'm really, for sake of argument in this conversation, talking about what might be called the organizing unions, a set of about 10 to 12 unions who, from the time that Sweeney was elected on, invested tremendous resources in trying to organize and grow the sort of service sector of the American labor movement, or in the case of the UAW, sort of rebuild their own base, right? So that's not most unions. So let's just be clear. Most unions are still not trying to organize American workers. They're just sitting on top of what was organized in 1930, 40, 50, 60, and watching it dwindle. There's a set of unions that began the movement in the 90s to begin to sort of organize again en masse and rebuild density in the American labor movement. That's who I'm really addressing in the book and in this conversation. Because the rest of them, you know, we're dealing with whatever, elements in the building trades, that racist, sexist, whatever, right? So those are not the unions that we're having a dialogue with in terms of community labor partnerships and this whole discussion of a reform progressive labor movement. So of the organizing unions, there, by the time I began to work at the AFL-CIO, there was an approach that said we have to go reorganize workers in this country because the labor movement's shrinking to, you know, tiny density. And among those unions, the core philosophy when you're in an organizing drive and you're actually working with workers and helping them form a union, one of the core things that we say, certainly the training I got in 1199, says that the union is not a third party inside the workplace, meaning the union is nothing more than the rank and file workers. That's a core message in an organizing campaign. So by extension, I would say, and that's because the boss, by the way, is going to come in the anti-campaign and the counter-mobilization, the employer's going to say, typically, we don't need a third party here to represent the interests of the workers. If the workers want to come talk to the boss, you know, the CEO would say, our door's wide open, come on in. So they're always positioning the union as a third party. And that's a big part of the employer message and the employer campaign against workers forming a union. So if you're a progressive union, if you're a smart union, if you're an organizing union, you're leading with a message that says the workers are not, the union is nothing more than the workers. It's very simple. The union is the workers. That's it. So by extension of that, where I began to have some confusion and tension with some folks in Lieberman is I would say, okay, well, following that philosophy, which is A, great, and B, correct, right? A good union is nothing more than the workers in the workplace. When you're organizing a union, the first thing the employer says is we don't need a third party. If you're an organizing union, the first thing we say back and the first thing that we've said to workers all along is, listen, a union is nothing more than the workers. And if you follow that extension, that sort of logic into the community, then I would argue that the union goes home with the workers. If a union is just the rank and file members, then obviously the rank and file members take the union home with them in their community. So when we say community labor partnerships, to me it's bifurcating an old notion of sort of separating the workplace from the community, as if the worker isn't a member of their community. When in fact, when workers leave work every day, they go home to a ton of complicated problems in their neighborhood. But if what we've done is built a successful union, meaning that workers have now formed a collective identity together in the workplace to fight for what's better, why wouldn't those workers go home into their community and fight as a collective in their community, as a union, essentially, for the kinds of things that workers need when they go home, whether that's safe water, whether that's better schools, whether that's affordable housing, whatever the issue is. So to me, the idea that we have some organizations responsible for community issues, quote unquote, and some organizations responsible for union issues, quote unquote, it flies in the face of the deepest philosophy about if the worker is the union, then to me, therefore the worker also takes the union home into their community. And it's when, and if you look at being in a moment when we're at 7% of workers in the labor movement in the private sector, if you look at that, the whole worker philosophy says, look, the fact of the matter is, if the American labor movement wants to relate to the American worker right now, they've got to lead on issues that are outside of the workplace. That's how we're going to rebuild a relationship with the American worker, is by working on things like housing, childcare, climate change, floods, etc., and build a relationship with American workers by having a dialogue around issues that matter to them all the time, every day in their neighborhood and their community. And that's going to allow us to build a profound relationship that the worker then takes into a workplace and decides, hey, this organization, this is a good thing, this union that we're, this is a really great thing that we're fighting around childcare in my community and affordable housing, and why don't we go do this at work too? That was the whole philosophy we espoused in every campaign we ran. And what's sort of not refutable about the decade that I spent in the labor movement is that we won almost every single campaign for 10 years. So there's something to the notion that if we relate to a worker on a broad set of issues and you acknowledge that many issues matter as much to them as what their paycheck is going to be at work, that you can build a very deep, high relational sort of engagement with the workers.
Okay, let's get a little more concrete now. Stanford, that was early proving ground for your approach. Tell us what were you doing there?
You know, so in Stanford, we arrived there, and there were a few unions. There's a few really good unions in Connecticut, but essentially, the same, Connecticut was sort of a microcosm for what happened around America. Essentially, as the economy shifted in Connecticut, as Connecticut deindustrialized, the membership of the unions wasn't keeping up with where the growth was in the economy, the changing economy in Connecticut. So as the fire industry, right? Finance, big
finance
corporate headquarters.
Insurance, real estate, yes.
Yes, came into Connecticut and began to really occupy Connecticut in Fairfield County. The labor movement had a base in the industrial cities, in the older cities in Connecticut. So the whole point of the Stanford Project in Connecticut was to see, could we go into sort of basically red, what felt like sort of reddish turf within a blue state of Connecticut, sort of hostile turf, suburban turf, a place where unions don't do very well in America. There were explicit challenges that we were handed. Could you go into suburbs where there was essentially no unions and begin to rebuild the labor movement from the bottom up? And could you do it quickly? Could you win? Could you win LRB elections? Could you win great contracts? And could you shift the fundamental metric, which is that most unions were getting hammered and losing in NLRB elections. And if you look at some of the concrete research that was done by Kate Bronfenbrenner and some other people later on, they quantified the disastrous numbers that the bad success unions were having trying to win elections, and very importantly, win their first contracts. Again, most people don't understand in America, because we understand so little about unions in America, most people in America don't understand that the boss takes two full whacks at stopping the unionization effort among American workers. The first is to stop the election if it's an election, or the card count if it's a card count. But then, even if the workers in America vote to form a union, a majority of workers vote to form a union, or a majority of workers sign a card count for membership in a union, they're not actually going to become members of the union unless they win and secure a first contract. Now, hardly anyone knows this outside, because it's such a complicated sort of manufactured complexity inside the labor movement, right? But the laws, the legalization of the labor movement. So the metric challenge to us was twofold. Could we win elections fast and repeatedly? And could we win first contracts within a one-year time frame? And people weren't saying to us, by the way, and can you win good first contracts? That becomes part of the fissure of the American labor movement in the last decade. But we were working with very good unions in Connecticut who had a tradition of having good contracts. So our local unions actually cared about winning high-quality contracts with the workers, which put them at odds with most of the labor movement at that point. So when we walked into Connecticut, despite a couple of very good unions already on the ground, they had won two elections. They had been stalled in trying to get first contracts in two different unions. They were really stuck, having horrific fights against the bosses with essentially no support. No one in Fairfield County understood what a union was. The demographics had totally changed. People had grown up without unions, even though if you go back to 1945 and 46, the general strike in Stamford, Connecticut was incredible, but that history was long gone. So we essentially said, look, we've done a power structure analysis, which is a big thing that we did, this model called doing a power structure analysis. We understand now where the power is moving in this broader county. And now what we have to actually understand is...
Just a word about that power structure analysis. You take some time to identify who the machers are in the community, right? Who the movers and shakers are, who has political and economic power, which is important to mapping your strategy, right?
Yeah, it's actually centrally important, so I shouldn't breeze over it that quickly. But, I mean, I think one of many critiques that I have about what we could be doing better in the labor movement right now is fundamentally making the time to understand regional power structures every place we go. Many union campaigns that I watch run into a community, have no idea who leads who, who's in charge, who's really pulling the power punches in a broader community. It could be a large city, it could be a small city. Launch into a big campaign, get in trouble, and basically can't pull it out because they've made the wrong alliances from day one, they've made their right. So part of the model is about spending some very significant time on the front end doing real homework. And I don't mean just corporate research, right? That's what unions traditionally do. This is a model of sort of understanding power in the much broader political, social, economic community of any given area. So we do that as step one. And that model comes from someone named Anthony Thigpen, who was someone I was trained by when I was young, doing community-based organizing work. So I brought a sort of model that came out of the environmental justice movement with me into the labor movement. And that's the first foundation of it. It starts with looking at research and power very differently than unions traditionally do. So we spend a few months in Connecticut looking at power, and that's when we begin to realize, boy, we're up the creek without a paddle here, folks, because we've got no way to crack the power structure down here. There are none of the progressive groups that were based in Hartford, New Haven. There's nothing down here. So we're going to have to build our support from the ground up, and we're going to have to crack the elites from below. And the way that we realize we're going to be able to do that is, so we do the power structure research, we begin to understand, okay, I'll give one example, black churches. All right, the black churches definitely have some power in Fairfield County for lots of historic reasons, but they're real. each municipality by each municipality, they've got real voting power. In municipal politics, they didn't have enough power to sort of take a statewide election, but we were looking at messing with regional power. And the black church in Stamford, in Norwalk, in Bridgeport, in all these sort of towns, really mattered a lot to local mayors, mattered to local city councils, mattered to people that we began to understand we could wedge in the local, in sort of fights between big corporations and local elites. This is maybe a whole separate discussion that could go on for hours, because the theory of power that we were using is very underattended to, I think, in the whole progressive movement in America. We just don't think enough about power, power structures, and how to attack them. And in this model, we thought a lot about power and how to divide and conquer elites. And what we understood was that ordinary workers could actually divide and conquer elites via the institutions that they were already members of in their community. And that's really the heart of the model. So once we understood which congregations, which temples, which ministers, et cetera, held some kind of power over community decision-making, over mayors, over town councils, over elites in the region.
These are the kind of people that mayors and city council members, they return their phone calls.
Absolutely. I mean, they don't return their phone calls to ordinary workers usually. Right. But boy, the mayor is going to absolutely return the phone call to the black minister in town. There is no question about that, right? Because the mayor's going to expect to come through that church in the week leading up to Election Day and get on that pulpit and indirectly be asking for support at the polls. So, you know, one thing we just in general don't do in this country is understand local and regional power. And it's to our disservice. And again, this goes back to sort of my critique of the labor-community partnership work, the way we do it in most models. This model is really different. This model puts workers in charge. And it says, fundamentally, we have to divide elites, that there's different interests between multinational corporations as they come into a region and sort of landed power and local and regional elites. And we intentionally sort of understood that model and began to sort of sow division among it, using the best folks we had, which were the rank-and-file members of the unions. So we had a couple of, again, we had two shops sort of in the unions when I arrived in Connecticut, in Fairfield County, and they were just stuck. The bosses were killing them. They're big corporate bosses in one case, Vencor, which has changed names 10 times since that, you know, since the book was written, right? It's a big multinational healthcare company. Every time it gets liability or a lawsuit or it wants to change something, it changes names. At the time it was called Vencor, it was notorious for healthcare workers in this country because it was big. It was out of Kentucky. They were ruthless. They beat unions all the time in elections, just crushed them with very sophisticated campaigns. So that's the scenario we walk into. And then in the case of the UAW, the United Auto Workers actually had just organized about 580 municipal workers in Stamford. And the mayor was just hammering them. And they were struggling very hard to get any traction at all up against a very powerful mayor, who, by the way, is now the governor. So he was ambitious. And part of the power model was also understanding and tracking ambition. Local politicians in any region who are ambitious are ripe for training, as I like to call it, by ordinary people. So we began to then chart, have conversations with the rank and file workers. We actually began to talk about the power model. We had the workers involved, by the way, in the model. They're deeply involved in the model of power research that we do. They hold very unique understandings of how power moves in a community. And so having the workers front and center in this model is fundamental. And I say, parenthetically, I say when I do trainings in the model, in the labor movement, I say the kind of research that you do portends the kind of union that you build. And if all you do is top-down corporate campaign research, where you have air wars and you've got people with lawyers and stakeholder and corporate, you know, sort of attacks going on from these very high-level places, you're not going to build a union that's empowering workers. So our model put the workers right into the research model. We would bring workers in and talk about power with them. We would ask who politically comes to your church at election time. Is it Congressman at the time, Chris Shays, who represented the region, sort of a famous moderate back then and when there were Republican moderates? You know, or is it the local dog catcher? And there was huge variations, right? And that question alone did several things for the rank-and-file worker. One, we began to empower workers early on to understand that they had power in their community. They didn't just have power at work. They actually had some kind of social power, too. And two, they had insights into information. You can't go do research on who walks into a church at election time. You're not going to find that in a database anywhere. So the model starts by empowering workers from the very beginning. And we talk about power explicitly all the time with them. And then, fast forward, you know, you take sort of the research we're doing on who maintains power, who controls power, how it moves, and we begin to map the workers by political precinct, by school, by church, by PTA, by Little League, to understand how the workers themselves are going to go try and attack and divide the elites in the region. And that, in summary, is what we spent several years doing in Fairfield County, Connecticut. And the workers took their bosses on at work, on the first shift, second shift, and third shift, in church, in the pulpits, in voting precincts, in school board meetings. The workers were challenging the entire power elite of Fairfield County and winning at every turn. And that's the foundation of the model. And it's really different than what's happening in the American labor movement.
We're listening to Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, just out from Verso. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
With a mess, and she's trying to keep it clean. Ladies with appliances, does dishes and machines, and everything has made way. She's as efficient as can be. Now she's cleaning up my room. Ladies with appliances, threw away her fruit, she's got a sonic vacuum now.
That was some of Ladies with Appliances by the early 80s Indiana punk band Dow Jones and the Industrials. I got it off an excellent premium CD, Robot Dance Party, put together by Liz Berg of WFMU, the world's greatest radio station. Now on to part two of my interview with Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, just out from Verso.
Okay, so you moved on to the alluring town in the desert, Las Vegas, which was a big nut to crack. You found a very dysfunctional union there and tried to whip it into shape. We do have only about 15 more minutes, so let's just do the quick story of Las Vegas. Now I want to talk about union culture after that.
Yeah, Vegas was, again, in some ways, it teaches some of the same lessons and some different lessons, but they're all related. First of all, they're related to real rank and file worker power. That's what everything we did for 10 years was about. So, but empowering workers at work, at home, in their community, everywhere they went. So, when we walked into Vegas, I would say it's also a metaphor for a lot of what's happening in America right now. It was a moribund union local. It was not exactly the kind of union that would make anyone run home and feel proud of. And in a right-to-work state, by the way, let me explain what a right-to-work state is, right, for just a minute. In a right-to-work state, it means many things, but that the core belief, the core legal difference between sort of a New York, a Connecticut, and a right-to-work state like Nevada is that workers don't have to join the union. Even if a majority of workers vote to form a union inside of a shop and survive, the death march, the employer puts them through to win their election, and then survives and wins a first contract, so they go through the double test of winning a union once and then winning it again, they never have to actually join the union in a right-to-work state. So right-to-work states, generally, you can overlay them with the red states in America. Basically, what we consider a red state politically overlays almost perfectly with sort of right-to-work states. So we went into Nevada understanding. We had done a lot of research. I had been working as deputy director for the healthcare division in the intervening years between being in Connecticut and then going into Vegas. We understood that Las Vegas in particular and Nevada generally were going to be very important states for a union that wanted to organize the national healthcare industry. Why? Because very high profit hospitals of very important national chains and regional chains were located in Las Vegas in a pretty non-union environment, in a right-to-work environment. So it was a very big challenge to think about how we were going to help workers form unions across that market and win really big, important standards in their contracts. And I have to say, and the book outlines all of this, first of all, I was sent to Nevada, but I was hired at the graces of the local executive board. I was not sent in, as an agent of Andy Stern, certainly. In fact, the book details, I had been run out of the union several times by his top team before going to Las Vegas. But the person who asked me, really, to go meet with the rank-and-file leadership in Las Vegas and consider working there as the executive director of the union was someone named Larry Fox, and also Eliseo Medina. and who was at that time the executive vice president, who continues to be a major force in sort of running progressive immigration campaigns in America. So those two leaders had a pretty progressive vision. And I, certainly Larry Fox, believed differently than the dominant model in National SAU at the time, that the way that we were going to help build the union movement was by winning fantastic contracts with the workers themselves, and that it was by winning fantastic contracts by workers changing their lives fundamentally, that that was the way that we would then spread and grow the labor movement. There's a huge debate among the organizing unions, and certainly the SAU is the epitome of the debate. Headquarters at that point was dominated by Andy Stern's top person, Tom Woodruff. He's a very well-known figure among the organizing unions. He goes on to be sort of the key staff person, key agent, what was called Change to Win at the Breakaway Federation. And it was Tom Woodruff's philosophy that I was battling, and that, by the way, Sal Roselli and a bunch of people were sort of battling. His philosophy essentially said, we're going to go grow the union by large agreements. We're going to cut deals with corporate bosses. We're going to get a sort of simple rule to hold the election. And we're just going to grow. In about 20 years, when we rebuild density to 25% or 20%, that's when we can begin to win good contracts again.
But in the meanwhile, workers get crappy contracts.
Yeah, absolutely acceptable. That was part of the model, period. So there were
and that was one of the selling points, in fact, that the employer didn't have to worry about demanding workers, demanding
centrally. Yeah. Centrally. And in fact, in some of those agreements, in the worst agreements, as you will see happens in Nevada, in some of those agreements, which were often A, negotiated in secret in the later years, they actually, the deals actually made it so that workers didn't have access to all the traditional rights that workers would have when they form a union. In some of the contracts in California, they were prohibited from utilizing something called the arbitration clause. That's what the national headquarters of SAU would agree to in order to get the corporation to sign the deal. In the case of Nevada, as we tell the story, unbeknownst to me, there had been an agreement that said workers could not picket nor strike against the employer. That was a sort of new news to me in the middle of a big fight, as this book explains. But at a philosophical level, the debate was really sort of the Woodruff camp, which was the Andy Stern camp, which said, we just need to grow, make corporate deals, grow, agree with the employer. There'll be sort of not a big demand in the contract stage. And then once some magic moment occurs in 20 years or something, we'll start winning high standards for American workers. And Larry Fox and I and many others simply didn't believe that. We had a very different philosophy. And the philosophy was an 1199 sort of philosophy, which said, no, first of all, workers are going to build the union. They're not going to get dealt by some weird corporate deal. They're actually going to grow their own union. And second of all, the way that we're going to grow the labor movement is by workers telling workers, in new markets and expanding out, look how I just changed my life. So in Nevada, in the very first two contracts we won against a ruthless corporation called Universal Health Services Corporation that had, by the way, there wasn't any other place in the country where people were members of, where there was rank and file unions at Universal Health Services, except in California, there were a couple of nurse contracts in the beginning. They were actually decertified in the time that I was in Vegas. And there were some archaic contracts somewhere in Pennsylvania where workers of a different union had them under contract. So essentially, we come into Vegas in the very first fight. The workers are just going up against this huge corporation. And we, from day one, say, look, the first thing we have to do is show that we can rebuild the labor movement by winning really great contracts. And it goes off seamlessly. We have a hell fight that was beautiful with 1,000 nurses who were fighting with pitchforks, tooth and nail, right to the final end of the contract fight with the employer. The first contract victories in those two hospitals set the highest wages ever known in Las Vegas hospitals, set the first fully employer-paid free health care in the Las Vegas market, set essentially standards that had been unheard of anywhere in Las Vegas. And what happened from there was an exact codification of the 1199 philosophy, the sort of dueling philosophy inside the union. Our whole union just began to spread. Headline, you know, we were had taken the first strike votes ever in a Las Vegas hospital. We averted the strike that first round. We would later strike. But in that first contract fight, We were able to avert the strike because the employer caved, frankly. And the workers were hellacious in their campaign. They were owned their hospitals, two hospitals, by the end of that fight. There was nothing happening in those hospitals except high-quality patient care and workers taking on bosses every single day at work. And the boss at some point just said, man, I want labor peace. I got to get, you know, they thought they were going to get re-control of their hospitals. So they surrendered. And the contract standards that the workers won through very hard collective action were extraordinary. Again, unparalleled ever in the history of Las Vegas, as was the first strike votes. And from that, the headlines are being carried every day. You know, the newspapers were covering a countdown. Two of the stations had a countdown that was 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, you know, days to the first strike in Las Vegas history, blah, blah, blah. In the hospital industry, certainly the casino workers had famous strikes, but never in the hospital industry or any other industry, really. So, yeah, we were like all news all the time every day in Vegas at some point because those workers were just burning down Las Vegas in a great way. We win the contract. The news begins to spread about what the workers won. A lot of those workers did what was called a per diem shift, a part-time shift in other area hospitals to pick up extra money. So now you've got the workers carrying the story into their hospital. Look what we just won. It was like workers were running around like the shackles of prison had come off them, holding up what they had just won, telling other healthcare workers who didn't have unions yet in Nevada what they had just done, what they themselves had achieved by forming a strong union. And that's sort of the beginning of the end of the story. We go on to win and win and win and win and win and organize the market on the backs of workers winning, not workers waiting 20 years from now to win a standard.
Now, even some of our better unions, the model is they bring in consultants and pollsters and ad people, and it's just publicity and, you know, and professional negotiators negotiating in secret. You, at points, brought in scores, even hundreds of workers into negotiations. This is totally unheard of in the labor movement, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty unheard of. I mean, there are certainly a small handful of unions that have what are called open negotiations, like 1199, probably here in New York, and certainly in New England, where I was trained. I bring 50 workers, 40 workers, you know, 60 workers maybe, where I had been trained. But the philosophy there was, I mean, the more I began to bargain contracts as an organizer, right? So I think that I adopted a different philosophy for several reasons. First of all, I came from 1199 in training, and they do what's called open bargaining, meaning anyone's allowed to come, but they don't try and bring the whole damn facility, right? Which is what we were doing in Vegas. We were trying to bring every single worker not on shift every time we had negotiations, and a bunch of workers who were on shift come in during your break periods. When I describe this to other trade unionists, they, I think I should be committed or something, because they can't imagine that it works. And the truth is, what didn't make sense to me as an organizer who thinks about power every day, in this case, workers building power, that the contract is the most powerful moment in the life of a worker. It's the only time in the life of a worker when they sit down across from their employer as legal equals. So in my mind, why, if there's this sort of legal framework where workers sit down as equals and get to look at their employer and either nicely or with their finger pointed at them, say, you know, the third shift here sucks. You know, we've got 40 patients and 8 nurses on the night shift. Let me tell you about how it feels to try and get my job done when there's 6 or 8 nurses. And, you know, the whole model was that the workers would come in and actually talk. You know, I had workers talking in negotiations themselves all the time. This is a very different way to do bargaining contract. And we did it routinely, systematically, all the time. I cannot think of a more democratic collective bargaining process than what we were doing in Las Vegas, Nevada, and not just Vegas. It went on to be Elko, Reno, right? We began to organize the entire state of Nevada. And in every single contract that we bargained, we took up this very different approach of having maximal input by workers. We would have workers take their lunch breaks at bargaining. We'd have tons of food. We'd have childcare in the room. We'd have workers bring their kids to bargaining with them. And the room would be silent when the employer walked in with the big boss law firm from out of town. And these were mostly big corporations we were dealing with, right? With big highfalutin lawyers flying in from Georgia, from Florida, from California. Because none of these big corporations let their local managers bargain, which is sort of like labor, right? I mean, they're usually flying in big. But this is a model of organizers doing bargaining, which is an 1199 model, by the way, right, that I come out of. So, you know, I was trained by Jerry Brown, and he said to me, organizers are the best people to bargain because you understand power. And a contract is about a power fight. screw the language and the law. Now, you got to know your language, too. But bargaining is about power. And I would say to the workers all the time, your contract is nothing more than a reflection of your maximum power at the moment that we settle. So how much power you can build against your employer is what you're going to win in your contract. These were like beautiful, open, pedagogically interesting Economy 101 discussions with thousands of workers that we were engaging in Las Vegas. Workers began to understand how contracts worked. They began to understand the finances of the employer. They began to understand every damn thing about how the profit margin worked in the facility. And that, I would argue, is what then led to part of the sort of size of the victories that we were winning. The more the workers understood about how the process worked, the more they were invited to be leaders in the process of fighting for their own and negotiating their own contracts, the more they understood that the entire possibility for victory rested in their hands. It wasn't going to be Jane McAlevey sitting in a room having a little wand in my hand that was going to be the way that they won their contract. And it certainly wasn't going to be some lawyer flying in from out of town from headquarters or from some law firm that SAU typically uses to bargain. It was a very radical conversation that your power as workers and your ability to fight for what you want is what's going to win and nothing else. And at every single turn, the workers stood up and fought. And I think having transparent, really big open negotiations was fundamental. We had a union that had been, if anything, just inept, frankly, in the years before I arrived there. And so workers didn't like their union. They were skeptical of it. Most of the good workers thought it was like not a very good thing, and none of them were paying dues, and they didn't like it, and they weren't part of it, and they didn't know anything about it. So for me, a simple transformational moment was saying, let's have a transformational model. We're going to open up the entire bargaining process. You will watch. There'll be no secret deals cut here. This is going to be your process. When we say the worker is the union in the model that we were operating under, we meant it. And I said to the workers, you want to win fully employer-paid health care? You're paying $400 right now for dependent coverage for your kid. You want to go from $400 a month as your dependent coverage bill to free? Gee, you better get 90% of the workers fighting with you and ready to strike, because that's what it's going to take. And if you do that, we're going to win. And that's exactly what we unfolded in Nevada. And in the course of 3 years, we changed the economics and the rights of workers in some of the big... I actually don't know a similar market standard shift in a 3-year period in contemporary times. Going from $400 a month, just healthcare alone, most workers are paying $400 a month dependent coverage. They go to 100% fully employer paid healthcare. Workers on average every year were getting 10% raises, if not more. In the rebalancing and the creation of what we're calling wage scales, there were workers getting 37% raises, 25% raises, and these are from corporations that could pay. We're not talking about bankrupting a company, right? We've done really good homework on the companies. The workers understand what the company can take. We're talking about cutting into the profit margin of a son of a bitch CEO named Alan Miller in the case of UHS, where the guy's taking home $25 million a year, where the corporate profits are soaring out the door, and they've got workers held to poverty wages. Where we took the victory, where the money came from for the workers, was from the shareholders and the CEO and the executive pay compensation. That's it.
We're just about out of time, but this perhaps might surprise people. Learn this, that this did not win you friends in the leadership of the union. I want to conclude by just talking about the culture of American labor. It is insular, paranoid, and frightened of both people outside, but also the members. Why is the leadership so afraid of the members and mobilizing the members in the way that you have been talking about?
You know, I think it's a slightly tricky question, but I think it comes down to some really basic things. On the part of more conservative elements of the trade union movement, you know, if you empower workers at the level that we were empowering them from Connecticut straight through to Nevada, it means that you can't just waltz into a big corporate deal and sign away agreements on behalf of workers, because they may not go along with it, because they actually might want to have a say in it. That's step one. The second is that when you really empower workers the way that we're talking about, they might decide to run for local union office. They might decide that they themselves want to shift who's in leadership in the union. And there's a lot of people in the trade union movement very invested in keeping their jobs. A lot. All across the board.
It's going back to working in the line.
That certainly does beat back going to work in line. And in the case of the people who had been running and holding the workers back to an inept union that had about 25% membership in the private sector and a little bit higher in the public sector when I arrived in Nevada. You know, why would those workers want to go back? I mean, in the case of the rank and file workers, why would they want to go back to working on the line? In their cases, working in the hospital. They didn't. But you know what? I'm sorry. That's too bad. They had a decade to try and build a good union. They didn't. They went straight into the culture of having secret negotiations, five workers in a room, no one involved. And that's that. You know, we can keep doing that model in the labor movement, and we're not going to have any unions left in several years. It's just not going to work. The way we're going to rebuild the union movement is when workers feel really proud of and own their union. And the only way to allow that to happen is to build sort of feisty, hyper-democratic unions. It's challenging, but it's absolutely the right thing to do. So I would try and get this out of sort of organizational democracy debates, because for me, the issue is winning. How do you win? The only way you're going to win is if you have the sort of much bigger radical model where workers are front and center, pulling up to the table with negotiations with their employer, instead of four or five people handpicked sitting in a room. It just doesn't... We've been doing it for years the old way, and it's not going to work.
Well, now it's easy to despair the American working class that they're, you know, passive and hopeless and ignorant and all kinds of disorganized, all kinds of terrible things.
It's just not
but
true.
But the story you've been telling shows that it's not true at all. Under the right circumstances, completely different story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the real reason why. You know, I wrote this book with Bob Ostertag. He's a longtime colleague and friend. He's a journalist, a very great journalist, commander of the Central American Movement many years ago. And it was really Bob saying to me all the time, the entire 10 years I was in the labor movement, just him listening to me, having conversations with him, boy, you gotta start writing this stuff up. You gotta actually tell the story. You actually need to lift up the evidence. There's evidence in this book. And the evidence is that American workers are not unwilling to fight. What you hear all the time, whether it's from boring labor leaders or academics who haven't left the walls of the academy for a long time, is, frankly, I'm sorry. American workers, when they're asked to stand up and fight, when they're involved in designing the strategy, when they understand the strategy, my experience is, and there's tremendous evidence in this book, they will fight every single time.
Yes, what a marvelous antidote to my usual despair. That was Jane McAlevey, author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, just out from Verso. The book is a marvelous account of how American labor can reverse its long, sad decline. Everyone who wants to make this a better country should pick up a copy and read it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of the Song Presenterator by Kevin MacLeod, also from Liz Berg's Robot Dance Party Premium CD, put together for a WFMU fundraiser. You can download it from their free music archive at WFMU.org. Till next week, bye.